Welcome to the spring conference. We're happy to welcome Dr. Marvin Olasky to be with us today and to speak to us on this topic of journalism. Dr. Olasky is the editor-in-chief of World Magazine. He's the author of 23 books and previously was a reporter for Yale Daily News and the Boston Globe, and has taught classes in journalism for 25 years at the University of Texas at Austin. He is author of the book Reforming Journalism, written in 2019, and we're thankful to have him with us today. Please give him a warm round of applause to welcome him. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for coming. Glad to be here at Mid-America Reform Seminary Spring Conference. Your professors and students have taken good care of me. Last night I had the pleasure of dinner with seven students and faculty members. Sitting directly opposite me was Professor Strange. He told me so many interesting things about church history that I later did what journalists do. I Googled him. And I learned that many Alan Stranges have garnered some attention. The first shown,
baseball player.
You got it, is a 19th. Very good, a 1930. You've Googled yourself, right? As I learned last night, Dr. Strange is a fan of the Chicago Cubs, as well as perhaps from a distance by admiration, the Boston Red Sox, which is the team I grew up with. The first Alan Strange shown is that major league shortstop from the 1930s, and the second is Dr. Strange here. But here's what I thought was strange about the information. The shortstop, Alan Strange, had the nickname Inky. Inky, I-N-K-Y, because he worked as a printer in the off-season. And that, of course, is the nickname that every scholar aspires to, and your professor deserves, because he has been very productive in scholarship. So I hope to leave you this afternoon with some deep, profound thoughts, but if I leave Professor Strange with a well-earned nickname, I'll feel I've done some good. So thank you, Inky, and thank you, the rest of you, for being here. Now, journalists who write long feature stories learn to start with a gripping lead, such as I have just provided. We then follow it up quickly with a nut graph, not because it's nutty, but that's the essence of the story, like a nut. And then a roadmap, where the story is going. So here's my nut graph. Every story has a worldview. Christians need to develop a biblical worldview and then put it into action. American journalism history shows us how to do that because American journalism started as Christian journalism. And we're in trouble because reporters have largely abandoned the Bible. But there is a proven way to recapture and apply biblical understanding to the news. Now, here's my roadmap through three lectures with slides that are prepared. Lecture one is a rapid-fire introduction to journalistic practice with an emphasis on how we can report at street level, not suite level, and how we can combine sensational facts with understated prose, not just yelling at each other. And lecture two is a journalism history highlights reel, how American journalism moved from the official story of colonial days, which was essentially public relations for the governmental powers, to the corruption story that dominated much of the 19th century, how all of us sin and fall short of the glory of God. Journalism in the 20th century moved to the oppression story. Big private institutions are the enemy. We need human gods within government to deliver us. And in the 21st century, we've had an odd melding of the official story and the oppression story. I'll go through this more, but just call it O&O for now. And then lecture three will take us from theory to practice with an examination of some reporting during the past seven lean years. And if we have time, I'll do what my dinner companions last night requested. I can tell a little about how God moved me from Judaism to atheism to communism to Christ. But before I get to that, let me just take a few minutes to explain why Christians in training to be pastors or other church leaders should care about this worldly stuff. When Luke Walkup invited me, he asked me to touch on how to live out of our identities as those who belong to the household of God, a pillar and buttress of the truth. and meditating on Luke Walkup brought me to a reporter named Luke, who lived 2,000 years ago. And Luke's gospel begins with his explanation of why he's writing. It seemed good to me, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account. That's a good roadmap for a journalist. And that's exactly what Luke did. He followed up his first long feature story, the Gospel according to Luke, with a second called the Book of Acts. And one of the scenes that reporter Luke provided us has the Apostle Paul visiting Athens and finding that its citizens would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. That, as you know, is in Acts 17. And that sounds like today, but America now is Athens on steroids, sometimes literally, but at least figuratively. And so our question is, how should those who belong to the household of God deal with today's current rush of information? In 1985, when Neil Postman wrote this book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, the threat was that we would have frivolous lives and die laughing. And since then, the torrent of news, augmented by Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook feeds, it's become a flood. And Postman's concern about escapism is still important, but here's a question for the present. With stories about shootings assaulting us day after day, will we die, not laughing, but crying? And lots of us fall into the world weariness evident in this lead to an Aussie news story a couple of days ago, another day, another horror. And happily, the Bible offers an alternative to despair in four psalms that are special to me. Maybe they can be for you as well. And I'll give you some key verses from those four and what they mean to me. Okay, first, from Psalm 131. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvelous for me, but I have calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother. So, that great and marvelous has obvious theological implications, but we can also apply it to the news. The Bible does not tell us to avoid big news from some other part of the world. It tells us not to be occupied with it. We can read headlines without spending time dwelling on actions over which we have no control. And God keeps an infinite number of balls in the air, but most of us can handle just one, like me, or maybe two or three, some of you. We need to concentrate on what we can catch and not what will cause us to drop our specific responsibilities and callings. Second, from Psalm 73, you guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will receive me to glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? That pretty much covers it all. Direction in this life, the hope and expectation of eternal life, and the Pascal's wager conclusion. What other choice do we have? When sensational media make it hard to be calm and quiet, it's time to read the Bible and take comfort in God's guidance, God's promise, God's uniqueness. And then third, from Psalm 92, and there are many parallel passages, how great are your works, O Lord, your thoughts are very deep, the stupid man cannot know, the fool cannot understand this, that though the wicked sprout like grass and all evil do is flourish, they are doomed to destruction forever. And that teaching runs clearly against contemporary wisdom. You may be familiar with psychologist Lawrence Kohlberg, who became prominent for suggesting that autonomous thinking is the seventh and highest stage of human intellectual development. And that's making ourselves into God. The highest stage is actually dependent thinking that recognizes our reliance on Him. And long ago, Augustine said, if you believe what you like in the gospel and reject what you don't like, it's not the gospel you believe, but yourself. And today we might say that if we're more desperate to keep up with the news than to keep up with the Bible, it's not the gospel we trust, it's our Facebook feed. And then fourth, two familiar verses from the beginning of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, the sky above proclaims His handiwork, day to day pours out speech, night to night reveals knowledge. And in 2021, our 24/7 news services pour out speech, but as you know, they don't glorify God. And yet we can also learn something from news that shows the sinfulness of man. The Bible, as you know, teaches that when man turns away from God, he acts like a beast. Ignore beastliness and we ignore essential evidence. If humans apart from God are not beastly, then Christ's sacrifice for us was unnecessary. So, keeping that biblical teaching in mind, I'm now going to turn to slideshow one, or maybe we can call it Journalism 101. And as you can see up there, understanding journalism starts with realizing that every story has a worldview. And this goes contrary to what some reporters learned maybe a generation ago, basically news from nowhere as if a machine was writing it. Well, no, every story has a worldview of some kind. I'll give you something simple, even a newspaper fire story. Okay? There are firefighters. They're the protagonist. Last night they battled the blaze, an antagonist. And because of high winds and low water pressure, those are obstacles, it took 2 hours to extinguish the flames. So there's their mission. When we teach students, we talk about, just so it sounds right, PAMO, protagonist, antagonist, mission, obstacles. That's the basis of every story in a way that moves people. Storytelling. Protagonist, and then just an order of logic here, protagonist, mission, antagonist, or antagonism, and obstacles. And that's very different from report writing. This is one of the first things when we have our World Journalism Institute classes, we have to tell students. A report is a report. It's a series of factual information and observations. A story in some ways has to have some movement in it. It has to enliven the heart as well as the mind. And PAMO sets it up. That's what reporters instinctively learn how to do. Maybe not instinctively, but over time they learn how to do it. You have to tell a story. And a good story has a protagonist, it has some antagonism. There are obstacles, there's a mission the protagonist wants to fulfill. There are obstacles that he or she have to do it. I'll give you another simple one, okay, Jack and Jill and the hill. Protagonist, mission, obstacles, okay? Jack's the protagonist here, Jill also. They have their mission, right, to go up the hill to fetch a pail of water, and then Jack falls down. And the question is, why does Jill go tumbling down after him? This is a certain mystery. And was that a right or wrong decision on her part? And here's the thing, the different worldviews will interpret that story differently. You know, it could be patriarchal. You know, Jill is not a klutz like Jack. Jack has gone tumbling down the hill. Why does Jill have to go tumbling after him? Well, because he's the patriarch. He's in charge. It's masculine superiority. She's stuck with that role. Or a feminist interpretation. Well, he's a klutz. She is much more competent. She feels sorry for him. Her compassion reaches out, so she goes tumbling down after him. Or maybe it's just an accident. You know, life is full of coincidences and accidents. There's no providence. So a different worldview, even a story like that, depending on how you tell it and how you examine it. I'll give you another story here. Three little pigs, right? They have a mission. Create dwellings. They have a very heavy-breathing antagonist, the big bad wolf. And the obstacles, you know, a couple of them are lazy. They may have a certain lack of realism about the dangers in the world. They think they can just build houses of straw or twigs or things like that, as opposed to the one who knows you need a brick house because he understands there's an antagonist, the wolf. Now we go to the Bible and we see parables. Good Samaritan parable. You know, the protagonist is the Samaritan. The mission is, you know, he's going in a particular direction, but because he's compassionate, because he's really doing what God's people are supposed to do, even though he's a Samaritan, he's willing to change his mission. He goes out of his way to help the person who's been mugged. What's the antagonist? The antagonist is selfishness. You know, the Levite, the priest and the Levite pass by. Maybe they're selfish. There's ritual uncleanness, perhaps. There are a whole bunch of reasons they manage to pass by, but nevertheless, the Samaritan doesn't. You know, pride of the passersby, perhaps. Now, if you had a story from another worldview, you could feature the good priest or the good Levite. Okay, they stop to, you know, help this guy who's bloody all over. They may be ceremonially unclean. They may not be able to complete their particular mission that's so important. So you could have the same parable with a very different purpose in it, but Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan. He wants to make the point. Now, every reporter, then, you might think, well, gee, you're just saying, and those of you who have ever taken a journalism course or heard of it, you know, who, what, when, where, why, how. You know, the five W's and the H. Who, what, when, where, why, how. Simple, easy as that? Well, no. Because you're always making decisions coming out of a particular worldview. Who's the face of your story? That's an expression journalists use. Who's your protagonist? Who are you going to select to represent a bigger problem or a bigger difficulty? You know, who? And it can vary a lot. For example, a few years ago, I mean, it still is, but maybe it's sadly not as controversial as it once was, when there started to be wrestling matches between young men and young women, or girls and boys, I saw stories right then from different worldviews that told the story in different ways. The New York Times had a story saying, well, of course, boys should wrestle against girls in this highly competitive way. you know, they're all human beings. Let them wrestle with each other. This is a great victory for mankind, womankind, humankind, for them to do it. There are other people who say, well, it's just not appropriate, really. I mean, they're not supposed to be touching each other in particular places, which you have to do if you're going to be a successful wrestler. So I saw other stories from a very different worldview. So who are the faces? You know, the face on one hand, you know, a 15-year-old girl who wanted to wrestle. The face in the other story, a 15-year-old boy who, while certainly respecting women, just did not want to go feeling women in those particular ways. What's your nut graph? You know, what's the essence of your story? What facts are most important? You know, any story whatsoever, there are going to be 50 facts. You know, how do you select the dozen that you have room for that are going to be most important? Who are your most trusted sources? Who are you going to rely on? Are you going to, if you have a story, let's say, about, you know, LGBT issues, are you going to look to a church minister who's Orthodox? Are you going to look for someone who's very heterodox? What's your kicker? That's a journalistic expression. And by the way, am I blocking the screen for you? And is there, well, you just got to live with it? Okay, carry on. You know, what's your kicker? Kicker is the last line of the story, essentially. The idea you want to leave in your readers' minds. And then how high or low in the ladder of abstraction will you go? And that's what I want to turn to right now, the ladder of abstraction. This is useful in journalism, but I think it's also useful in preaching. The single most useful tool we've found in training reporters, and to write visually in a way that gets people viscerally being able to understand what's going on, you want to descend the ladder. Give you an example here. I got here today to Mid-America Reform Seminary using locomotion or using my automotive mobility, using transportation. Those are pretty abstract terms up the ladder. I can come down the ladder to motor vehicle. I can come down the ladder to car. I can come down the ladder, say, to a Ford Fiesta or some other brand of a car. I can come down to what's the color of the car and so forth. So, you know, what's the license plate? The more specific you get, the more people can understand and feel the scene. And so reporters learn to write visually. Script writers learn to write visually. You want to actually be able to show what's going on in words. That's something I think it's useful in preaching also. You know, I would like to say that people who listen to a sermon, they'll come away remembering all the theological points, whether it's 3 points or 1 point or somewhat more. But you know, you probably perceive this very often. They'll come away remembering a particular story that you told to illustrate a theological point. That's the way we tend to function as humans. Politicians tend to be high in the ladder. Certainly, when it comes to abortion, the defenders of abortion tend to be high in the ladder. Sometimes pro-life people are high in the ladder also, and that's something we need to grow out of, basically. Pro-choice is obviously a high in the ladder term. Choice. Well, what kind of choice are you talking about? Is it a choice of cafeteria? Is it a choice for what kind of car to drive? Well, no, it's a choice of life or death. But, you know, pro-aborts don't want to really talk about abortion. So pro-choice, that's high in the ladder. Pro-life, you know, we should talk about babies. We should talk specifically about moms and dads. Pro-life is a good generic term. It's better than the term used in most major newspapers these days, namely anti-abortion or sometimes even anti-choice, but still high in the ladder. We want to come down the ladder to human life. We want to come down the ladder to unborn child. The most helpful development over the past 20 years has been the proliferation of ultrasound machines at pregnancy resource centers all over the place and other places too, because that allows a person to see not just a baby, but my baby. And that makes a huge difference in life or death decisions. So coming down the ladder is important in reporting. I'd say it's also important often in preaching. The expression show, don't tell, being low in the ladder. Human interest, specific detail. Street level, not suite level. Pavement pounding, not thumb sucking. This is what we tell our reporters. You know, get out and actually observe and watch and see and talk with people. Don't just sit in your office, suck on your thumb in an air-conditioned office and pour out opinionating. E.B. White, who was co-author of a wonderful little book. Any of you ever have the Elements of Style by Strunk and White? Okay, Doctor Strange. The rest of you, it's small, it's succinct, it's good, it's great. It's been through, I don't know, six different editions now, but Anyway, E.B. White, who also wrote a couple of very fine children's books, but was a fine editor, he said, don't write about man, capital M, write about a man. And that's useful advice, I think, and practiced by journalists. And Christian journalists need to learn this. I'll explain when I go into the history of journalism, the way that Christian journalists understood this, and then for a time they started to forget about it, went high in the ladder of abstraction, and lost their audiences. The prodigal son, another example, an example of low on the ladder of abstraction. It's not just abstract troubles, it's hunger. The prodigal son, the younger son, as you know, wants to be fed with the pods that the pigs are eating. So going low in reporting. Here are questions to ask, and again, in terms of sermon preparation, I would think even in writing about theology in ways that non-scholars will read, you want to ask questions. What happened? What's an example of that? This is what we train people to think. What's it like? What exactly did you see? You know, we'll tell reporters, if you're standing in front of the house and you see that it's white, you should not just assume that it's white all over. You know, 99% of the time it's going to be, but you should go around to the side of the house and make sure it's white all the way around before you describe it as a white house. So what exactly did you see? What precisely did he say? Journalism ethics, if it's within quotation marks, has to be precisely what the person said. You can leave out sometimes the ums and ahs and things like that, but you don't change around quotations. What was the turning point? Okay, this again is very important if you think of CAMO, you know, protagonist, antagonist, mission obstacles. What created a change at some point? What's the turning point? And then ask, what's your worst experience? This is the way when you're trying to get a person talking, superlatives is a very useful thing to do. What's your worst experience? What's your best moment? What's the hardest task? Gets people to think a little bit and then often talk. And that's what you were trying to achieve. Knowing your worldview helps you descend the ladder. And I will descend the ladder right now by descending the straw. This is what we call, and again, I'm going through this quickly. If any of you find this interesting, you want to learn more than, reforming journalism. If you don't want to shell out, I don't know, $18.95 or whatever it costs, okay. Luke there is holding it up. But, if you don't want to do that, just email me, marvin.olasky@gmail.com, and I can send you an electronic copy, which won't cost you anything. But, I do recommend that book. And this is what we talk about, the thaw approach to writing. Although, actually, I looked the other day, you forget what you've written. I'm not actually sure I put it in the book. Maybe I did, maybe I didn't. I'll have to look and see. Anyway, the thaw approach is useful to have. Thinking, hunting, analyzing, writing. In other words, before you go out, you have to think, okay, how am I understanding the story? What do I think the basis of the story is? And then you may change. You will probably learn a lot that causes you to change how you perceive the whole thing. But everyone goes out. Every reporter goes out with some worldview. And you need to know, okay, which pieces of metal to pick up, which to leave behind. Otherwise, you just have a report, not a story. You have to be ready to shift while you're hunting. So you think about it, what do I think this is about? Where am I going to go looking? Who am I going to talk with? And then the more you learn, you shift it, you learn things, but you're hunting for a specific detail which will affect your thinking about things. Then you are analyzing then what you have, and then eventually you are writing it. But it's that whole process that you have to go through, and I can explain more about that later if you're interested. Why have a biblical worldview? Okay, this is a dumb question in lots of ways, but I sometimes try to explain this to non-Christians. And essentially, to understand a house, you read the blueprints. This is oversimplified. You know, here's the house that God has made for us, namely the world. Here's our blueprints, is oversimplifying it, but here's our thing that helps us understand how this world is made. The house my wife and I bought in Austin in 1997, the builder of the house at first lived next door. And it's a really tall house on the side of a hill in Texas with a little Texas brag. It's called Edwards Mountain, but it's really a hill. But it's kind of a steep driveway, and it has these big metal posts. And it's a tall house, and so if I don't know what it would do in an actual hurricane with winds over 75 miles per hour, but we've had maybe 55 mile per hour winds, and at the top it's like a little bit like being on a ship. It actually sways a little bit, and that got me wondering. And so I asked the builder, who lived next door, and he was able to say, "Well, no, don't worry about it. Here are these posts. They're really thick. They're deep down. They're in the rock. It's not going anywhere." God lives next door. I mean, He's left us the Bible. We can see it. We can read it. We can understand how this house of ours is constructed. And so at World, we talk about biblical objectivity. Namely, the old journalism was, objectivity is really a balancing of subjectivities. You talk to person X, you talk to person Y, you quote them both, and voila, objectivity. Well, not necessarily so. I mean, X and Y may both be way off. Maybe yes, maybe no. It doesn't necessarily leave you with objectivity if you just quote a couple of people. Biblical objectivity is trying to describe the world God has made in the way He helps us to understand by giving us the Bible. And it's very different from either the balancing of subjectivities approach or the existentialist subjectivity approach, where you just sort of give your opinion and with no real basis except maybe your feelings at that particular time. And as Bob Dylan's saying, you got to serve somebody. You're going to have to serve somebody. Well, maybe the devil or maybe the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody. And so, as I try to explain to skeptical journalists why is having a biblical worldview particularly important now, the pressures to join some big political association or become part of a particular faction, to become part of a particular tribe, and just tell the news from that tribe's perspective, whatever it is, those pressures are immense right now. As we talked about last night, the New York Times and the Washington Post have monetized that. I mean, they no longer try to have stuff that's useful to say both conservatives and liberals. They have become very financially successful, even while losing a lot of local advertising and a lot of local readership. They've become very successful by selling online subscriptions all across the country, in some cases all around the world. And it's worked because they have a particular perspective and they push it hard. Fox News has become successful by pushing a conservative perspective. That can be a problem at times. At World, we are certainly theologically conservative in terms of biblical inerrancy. We also tend to be politically conservative, but we've differed with a lot of conservatives on questions of admitting refugees, on some immigration questions. Many years ago, I worked with then Governor George W. Bush of Texas in developing what was called compassionate conservatism at the time. So we deviate from some run-of-the-mill conservatism in a way that causes some of our readers dyspepsia. But that's who we are, and we try to read the Bible and apply it, and we'll explain what we're doing. We don't try to hide, and we get letters saying, "I disagree with you on this particular thing, but nevertheless, I mean, I know you take this seriously, you're trying to apply the Bible, you have credibility," and so we get along fine for the most part. But that's the pressure these days is enormous just to join a particular faction, and that's the way to make more money, essentially, either on the right or on the left. So it's a hard thing right now. These are, what could I say, these are some journalists who have decided to get fat and happy by pandering to certain perspectives. If I wanted to go political, I'll give you the next one. Let's say these are Republicans searching for solutions. So I suppose I could get political and go back to Democrats here, but that would hardly be fair. We believe, you can hold up the book again, Luke. Yeah, okay. We believe in biblical objectivity, and that's how we hope to reform journalism. Reform, as you may imagine, having a double meaning. Biblical objectivity. Here's the question: how do you avoid either underusing the Bible, which is the tendency in liberal denominations, or sometimes overusing the Bible, which is sometimes the tendency in some very I don't know if I want to. It's not really a proper use of conservative, but I suspect you know what you mean. If someone says, I have a special message from God that we are supposed to locate a highway in this particular place, we should perhaps be skeptical about that, because some things biblically are very clear. Some things are unclear. We get closest to reality in our limited and fallen way by thinking biblically. And we don't want to underuse the Bible when it's clear. I mean, for example, we have today people saying, well, the Bible is actually pro-abortion. I've had an email discussion with one person on this. And that is a radical example of underusing the Bible when it's clear. Or adultery is fine. Again, a radical example of underusing the Bible, but don't overuse the Bible when it's not. And the analogy we use here, which we found very useful, is to whitewater rapids. The World Business Office is in Asheville, North Carolina, and 50 miles west of there are some very good whitewater rapids. When we had World Journalism Institute classes in Asheville, we would take the students, would-be journalists, out to go whitewater rapiding. I spent a week going down the Grand Canyon once. It's not like that. It's not. They're not waterfalls, but there's some white water. There's some excitement. Very often people end up in the water, and if I am captaining a particular rubber raft, just about everyone at some point ends up in the water. And thus it was a very useful training device for journalists who would tell us, hey, this is actually pretty safe, but if you get thrown out of the boat, just float downhill, feet first, and someone will pick you up, which is what happens. They say, do not try to walk, because, you know, in three people out of 10,000 actually who got thrown out of the boat did that, got their foot caught under a rock, pitched forward, and drowned. That's a very useful thing to remember. I mean, there are real rapids. It's not a theme park. There is danger. And this is what we think of when we talk about rapids. There are six classes of rapids. And here we try, this is the metaphor we use. So class one, when there's an explicit biblical command, you know, you shall not commit adultery. Class two, when there's an implicit command, and I can go through that in a moment. Class three, when there's a preponderance of Scripture, you look for the whole counsel of God, and I'll give an example of that. Class four, when you study history and human nature, and you can derive some things from that. Class five, it's less clear. There's some guidance from the study of history and a biblical understanding of human nature, but not necessarily something that's surefire. In class six, there's no biblical guidance. You know, I would say, for example, on this question, which world, Austin politics, and probably other places, where to site a particular toll road? The Bible does not give you particular instructions on that. That would be an example of a class six rapids. Class one is explicit. Okay, you shall not murder. Now, of course, we sadly have the add-on in modern America, well, you shall not murder unless the victims are tiny, then you can do it. You shall not commit adultery. And again, you know, these are sort of sarcastic parentheses here, you know, add-on, unless true love beckons, in which case, go right ahead. You shall not steal, and the add-on, well, unless you think you've been treated unfairly. You shall not bear false witness, unless maybe if someone has lied to you, then you can do reciprocal lying. And you shall not covet, which, of course, is something we all, as Paul knew, we all tend to do. But again, if you covet particular things these days, what an advertisement tells you to covet, then maybe that's virtuous. So a little bit of sarcasm here, but these are pretty explicit, and it's not that hard to understand. I'll give you a class two. I'll give you a class two plus, because this is how careful we want to be. Abortion is something I've written a couple of books about, and I'm 30 years after earlier writing, I'm embarked on a new book. So I am deep into the history of abortion, and that's basically what my book 30 years ago was about, and now with a lot of new research, I'm redoing it and adding to it. But I would say even abortion, in a sense, is a two plus. That is, it's just one small step. Obviously, I think if you know science at all, as well as what God says in Psalm 139 and lots of other places, the unborn child is a human being. But it is true that we do not have an explicit command: do not murder tiny human beings. It's not hard; it's right there. But there's one small step there, and that's why I would call it a two plus. It's still so clear that I'm just amazed and saddened that some people don't see it. But nevertheless, we want to be very careful about saying that, you know, what's explicit as opposed to what's implicit. And I'll give you some other examples, but reforming journalism goes into this a lot. So let me go to class three, because that's the that's a really difficult thing at times. I've had debates with Jim Wallace, for example, who's way on the left, about helping the poor. And I think you can see biblically, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted, be open-handed. You can see that generosity is important. You can see that work is important. Work is important to earn money by the sweat of our brow. Also to grow in patience and character is a great blessing from God to be able to work and to have work that glorifies Him. And so Jim Wallace would say, well, the generosity principle is such that you shouldn't worry about the work component. You should create, let's say, a universal income that everyone gets, work or not. But then I go to the Bible where Jesus asks, the person who's spent 38 years at the pool of Siloam, he asks, do you want to get well? And here's where our class three rapids comes in. This famous verse, which probably a lot of you memorized, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you drink? And King will answer him, truly I say to you, as you did to one of the least of these, my brothers, you did it to me. That verse, in my experience, cuts both ways. I spent a lot of time back in the 1990s talking with homeless guys and other people with very bad drug problems and other difficulties. And if you say, as you did to the least of these, you did to me, well, if you are just giving money, which being used for drugs or for an alcoholic, putting heroin into the veins of Jesus. This is a sad thing to do when you can actually be destructive. And when I was writing this type of stuff 30 years ago, it was a little out of the mainstream, but now there are lots of good books out called I wrote a book called The Tragedy of American Compassion, which goes into this and explains why historically just handing out money is not a good idea. But there are a lot of books like it now with titles like When Helping Hurts and so forth. So that's why I call it a Class 3 Rapids, because I don't doubt Jim Wallace's belief or Ron Sider, who I've had very friendly exchanges with. I mean, they're on the left. I don't doubt their Christian belief. I just think in Jim's case that he just interprets things according to using particular verses and ignoring lots of other stuff in the Bible. But this to me would be an example of just trying to understand how to avoid saying the Bible says something which actually it doesn't say. And this is a rapid disagreement. Class four, history and human nature. You've read this in the news, of course. Lots of movement to the left on college campuses and lots of other places over the past year. And Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist. The problem with that, there are a number of problems with that, but one problem is that when push comes to shove, when you have to decide what to do and whether to force people to do it, the democratic part of socialism historically just disappears. Power corrupts absolutely, words of Lord Acton in the 19th century. And we've seen historically what happened. Soviet Union, China, Cuba. I interviewed a couple of years ago Venezuelan refugees in the Miami area. The democracy goes out the window. At a certain point, do I really believe in socialism, which in many ways goes against the human nature that God has given us? Am I going to push it or am I going to give up on it in order to be democratic? And time after time, it's give up on democracy. And class six, again, this is a waterfall. Basically, a class six rapid, you go over, you're likely to die. And that's why we don't want to overuse the Bible. We don't want to say that things that are our personal preference. One story I knew a church where, weird as it sounds, I think the pastors were approving a particular type of tire, and I think they were condemning white wall tires, which may be, well, I'll just say that's. I hope none of you are doing that as you preach. There are classics around in the time. Some of you saying, "Yeah, white walls." Let me leave you with five things, and then we have a little bit of time for some questions. Biblical objectivity includes self-awareness. I mean, here, I don't know if you can see this, but, oops, go back to that. Here's, you know, we are not descended from monkeys, although you may be fooled at first glance. We tend to look in the mirror and we see ourselves as more powerful and smarter than we actually are. So we have to be self-aware that God is wise, we are not. And so biblical objectivity includes, you know, that we are dependent on God, not like Kohlberg's thing, the highest stage of intellectual development is being independent of God. Secondly, street level, not suite level. It is so easy just to take a press release that some official has thrown out and just run with that as opposed to going out and actually seeing for yourself. Sensational facts, understated prose. Again, you know, the British slogan, keep calm and carry on, is a wonderful slogan. These days, journalism sells. If it bleeds, it leads. So the more sensational, the better. The more anger, the better. Anger brings eyeballs. And the world we try to be calm and emphasize biblical objectivity. Four, we hear all these doomsday things. I grew up a 20th century Boston Red Sox fan, which meant at Fenway Park there would often be a loud fan sitting behind me who, if the Red Sox fell behind 2-0 in the first inning, he'd be yelling, "Down the drain, down the drain." We hear some of that now, and, you know, the sky is falling. Well, there are all sorts of bad things going on, but we still have hope and faith that God indeed is holding up the sky, and we are not going to prematurely give up and say the game's over because we're behind by a little bit right now. And then five, the most important thing of all, God saves sinners. A lot of you probably know this is J.I. Packer's very succinct summary of the gospel. God saves sinners. And that's the most important three words, I think, summing up theology that I know. And that's a hard thing, you know, that saved a wretch like me. And some people, they want to change the word, so it's not wretches. Well, that's who we are. God saves sinners. We are wretched without him. And we emphasize salt, not sugar. There are lots of publications. Again, the way to make the most money in journalism these days is to sell anger. Probably the second best way is to just deliver sugar, you know, just happy talk and news. And we try to be salt, which is a preservative, and it also makes things a lot more tangy. That's it for lecture number one. Comments, questions, differences. You will not hurt my feelings if you disagree. Any questions you want to ask, ask away. Yes, sir.
When you say understated prose, like, can you give kind of an example of what that would be like?
I'll give you a hot recent example. In the last election, clearly there were, in a few places, there were some things that were going on. As far as I've seen, looking at all the data I can find and listening to various judges who were looking at this data, there were small things. There wasn't enough to alter the presidential election, and that's the way we reported in the world. We reported that there were a few votes here and a few votes there. There are, overstated prose. An example would be stolen election. That's overstated prose. I don't know if some of you feel differently on it. If you have factual information that I haven't seen, I'll be glad to look at it. But that's overstatement. I was a poll watcher in Northeast Philadelphia when I was in college in 1970, and there were a couple things going on and a few votes here and there, but there wasn't enough to change the course of the election. So, stolen election. It's overstated prose. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. I think I misspoke, or maybe I misread it. I thought it said understated prose, buildings on fire, and someone says it's a little hot in here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would that be? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, that would be that. That's a good example of understated prose. If there's a, that would be. how to put it better. We don't want to just cater to anger. So we want to use understated prose when we explain factually what's going on, but we're not hysterical about it. We're not yelling down the drain. We're not yelling stolen election. We want to report when there's sensational news. We want to report it, but we don't want to. You know, we will say there was a murder, but we won't necessarily go through every single bloody detail of it. Sometimes we have to. Sometimes we have described what goes on during an abortion. But we want to be calm. Even when things make us very angry, we don't want to just cater to anger. We want to cater to reality. We want people to understand factually what's going on. And if it's sensational, so be it. But we are just trying to be anti-anger in the situation. We want people to be calm. The case you gave, if there's a fire and you say it's merely hot, that's not really what we mean by understatement, because that's factually incorrect. We want factual accuracy, but not hysteria. We don't want to say the sky is falling, basically, unless it really is, and sometimes it may be. In 1917 in the Soviet Union, in Russia at that point, the sky was falling in November of 1917. But I know I get letters sometimes from people saying, well, you know, America is becoming like the Soviet Union. Well, no. I mean, I was in the Soviet Union, and there's a big difference. So, yeah. Yes, sir. Yes.
Is there any way out of this money dilemma? Years ago, I remember seeing an episode of the Donahue Show in which his guest was the Soviet Russian equivalent of a Donahue host.
Uh-huh. Vladimir Posner?
I don't remember his name, but on his show, this Soviet person made the point to the American audience, was pushing back, your media is all driven by the government, the Communist Party, etc. He said, yes, and your media is driven by money and profit, to which Americans were aghast. No, it's driven by truth. But what I don't see, I mean, given what you said, is there any way out of this money-driven news media? I mean, what I miss is shows like the McLaughlin Report, where you got to hear a spectrum of views and they spar with each other. I don't find that anywhere, obvious at least, out in the world of media journalism. Maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, well, money always does have some influence. The way it used to work in journalism, the financial angle drove against extremes, because if you had a newspaper in a city, and most cities had only one newspaper, that was basically a license to print money, because grocery stores, department stores, other local institutions would advertise in the newspaper, unless the owners got so angry with the newspaper that they would boycott it in some way. So the goal was not to anger people. I grew up with the Boston Globe and worked on the Globe for a while. I mean, it was a very liberal newspaper, but it still did not want to anger conservative readers, because you wanted to keep those, you wanted to maintain your audience, which would include people on the right as well as people on the left, because it would have baseball scores and crossword puzzles and TV listings and stuff like that. You didn't want to anger them, because as long as you didn't anger them, this was going to be a very profitable enterprise. And reporters reluctantly went along with that. There were a lot of reporters who were ideologically committed, but they understood that they had to have some reserve there in the way they were expressing themselves. So the finances drove newspapers somewhat towards moderation. Today it's the exact opposite, because the advertising money isn't there anymore. Facebook and other things have just soaked up that money. And Twitter, which I'm on and so forth, so I'm part of the problem. But, you know, it just soaks up all that advertising money. And the way to make money is, you can't just depend on your locality. If you can develop a national audience in some way, then you can be profitable. And that's what the New York Times and the Washington Post have found. So they don't go, they have no reserve at all. I mean, the Washington Post, during the Trump administration, day after day after day, I mean, I was critical of President Trump on a whole lot of things, but the Washington Post, you just knew automatically it was going to be anti-Trump all the time with six stories blasting this or this or this. It had no credibility, but it was very profitable because it was able then to sell electronic subscriptions all across the country. And electronic subscription basically costs you nothing. If you have to actually deliver a newspaper, there are printing costs, there are delivery costs, which sometimes soak up half the budget, just those two things. Electronic subscriptions, wow, that's great. And the New York Times, by being a national and actually international paper, and the Washington Post, by essentially being, you know, a Washington paper, they have done great with electronic subscriptions. Newspapers elsewhere in the country are just failing, going out of business, laying off staff. It's been a very difficult situation for journalists. So what's going to change in that? You know, I hope at some point that the people will have enough of that and will just say, I actually want to see a news source that's credible. If the news source always agrees with my own prejudices, then I'm not learning anything. In world, basically, we tend to be supportive of the views of lots of our readers, but every issue I want to have some challenge in there, something to really make people think, oh, I need to think more about this, or read more about this, or learn more about this. That's an unusual thing. I'm glad we're able to do it. We've had a board that allows us to do it, but that's highly unusual. What's going to change it? Except God's grace, God's providence, God's mercy. You know, because politics is moving in this very polarized way. We haven't been this polarized since 1861, and bad stuff happened then. We were very polarized in 1800, and God was merciful in a lot of ways. You had the Second Great Awakening developing. You had other things that happened. But I'll explain more about this maybe in lecture two, which is on history. For right now, yes, sir.
So kind of jumping off on your comment about social media, like, yeah, there's a lot of algorithms that kind of cater towards people creating an echo chamber.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts about that and how the church can kind of combat against it?
Well, I should say the hard thing is that churches are also facing this. In a way, there are Republican churches and there are Democratic churches, which is not the way things are supposed to be. So how do you handle this? A couple of days ago, actually yesterday morning, we my wife and I left Springfield, Illinois. So I was just doing some Lincoln research in connection. I'm just seeing the analogies between the battle against slavery and the battle against abortion. And Lincoln gave a speech in New Haven when he was sort of making his eastern swing and preliminary part of his running for president. He gave a speech which was with Lincoln's wit. I mean, Lincoln was faced enormous abuse. You know, there were cartoons in the Lincoln Presidential Museum and Library in Springfield depicting him as an ape, as a vampire, as all kinds of really creative and crazy and nasty stuff. Interesting to see. So he faced a lot of abuse, but he always responded with wit. So I just recommend reading his speechifying as a way for number one, for a pastor to respond to some hostility from whatever side. You know, don't get angry and start shooting back. You know, and talk calmly and wittily if possible. That's a useful thing to do. But here's the problem. Lincoln, in talking about slavery, said that, hey, a lot of people just don't want to talk about it. This is obviously a burning issue. You can't avoid it. But some people just don't want to talk about it. And so they say, in the North, don't talk about it because we don't have slavery there. In the South, don't talk about it because there is slavery there. In general discourse, political discourse, don't talk about it because you don't want to bring morality into politics. And in the church, don't talk about it because you don't want to do politics from the pulpit. And so the result is it's not being talked about. And of course, it was talked about. It increasingly got talked about, and it could not be avoided. It was the irrepressible conflict at that point. So what's a pastor to do? There are, for example, coming back to this abortion issue that I'm looking at, there are so many places in Scripture where the value and significance of human life is affirmed that it's not as if the pastor has to wait, you know, once a year, maybe on the anniversary or the Sunday just before Roe v. Wade, maybe to mention something. Maybe just in passing, you want to do it. Now, some people say, well, you can't do that because so many people have had abortions. I mean, maybe one out of every five women has had abortions. There's probably some in your congregation. You don't want to offend them. Well, in terms of, I mean, I've talked with lots of people who have gone through that, who have had abortions, and they have to deal with it in some way. It's inescapable. It's there. And if you try to bury it, it's going to create all kinds of psychological problems at some point. You have to deal with it, and it's not... It is not an unforgivable sin or anything like that. You just got to deal with it. And pastors can do this. I mean, John Piper in Minneapolis has done this a lot. I've heard other pastors do it in a calm and compassionate way, but it's important to do, as opposed to, well, we can't talk about it because, well, is there something political about it? Well, there's life and death about it. And I don't think pastors should be evasive. So... anyway, does that get to it? Okay, good. Other questions? Yes, sir.
This is something I've been curious about for a while. In this age of information overload and everything coming at us like a fire hose in 280 characters or less, do you think that there's a sense in which, especially of the generation a lot of people represented here, there's a lack of critical thinking and critical engagement where they just kind of take what's been given coming like this waterfall, and they just pick and choose what they agree with and don't do a lot of the groundwork themselves?
Well, I mean, here this gets back to, for example, Facebook and the problem that increasingly you, in a sense, you create your own news environment. You are friends with some people, you read what they post, and then Facebook itself has a pretty heavy thumb on it. The disadvantage, okay, growing up in Boston where the Boston Globe was the dominant paper, there was another paper called the Herald, but it didn't have a whole lot of sway. The disadvantage was you got the Globe's worldview, which was a moderately liberal worldview. The advantage is that you didn't just get your own worldview unless you happened to be exactly tracking along the Globe. So you learned other things. I think conservatives have an advantage generally in American culture because our popular culture, our largest media with a few exceptions, our movies and so forth tend to be from a liberal perspective. So conservatives get the conservative perspective from people they know, and they get a liberal perspective just sort of watching television or seeing movies or things like that. That's actually very useful. Liberals don't have that advantage, and so the echo chamber becomes more radical all the time, and you see your own news feed, and you think your own news feed represents things. Back in 1972, when Pauline Kael was a noted movie reviewer in New York, she lived in Manhattan, and 1972 was a sweeping, massive election victory for Richard Nixon, and she was astounded by it. She said she didn't know a single person who voted for Nixon, and yet 60% of the country did. And then if you look at our last election, I mean, there are lots of people who are very firm Trump supporters, and they were amazed and astounded at the election results and thought there must be a stolen election or things like that because they didn't know anyone who voted for Joe Biden. So that's a real problem. And in some ways we're doing, you know, there's a book called The Great Sort. Gerrymandering congressional districts so they tend to be, you know, more monolithic in some ways. That's a problem. That all pushes us towards radicalism. If you want to read my favorite novel, it's called The Cypresses Believe in God. It's by Jose Gironella, so spelled G-I-R-O-N-E-L-L-A, Jose Gironella. It's called The Cypresses Believe in God. He wrote in the 1950s. It's about the Spanish Civil War, about the 5 years that led to the Spanish Civil War. And I've written columns about this every few years because I don't think we are going to have a civil war in 5 years, but... You know, the polarization is increasing that, you know, 20 years maybe, I don't know. It's a problem. And if you want to see just a really wonderfully written book, The Cypresses Believe in God, unfortunately, The cheapest copy out there that I've seen is about $60 because it's rare now. But if a public library has it, or a university library, or any of you, if you have good contacts with publishers and they can get the rights to reprint it, there's a market out there. At least I've been trying to create a market for it. So anyway, that's what's going on now. I wish you were better, but the good news is right now for y'all and me, it's 2:00, so time to stop. And I will see. I will see if any of you are back here in half an hour. I'll be. We'll see about you. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention.